Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald, here on Monocle 24. This week, we're celebrating the legacy of one man who has arguably contributed to modern Britain more than any other, Sir Terence Conran. We visited the great and good of the UK design industry to find out what Sir Terence is all about. Coming up on the show, London's legendary style commentator Peter York paints the picture of what life was like when Terence made his first splash on the scene in the 60s.
It was as if we'd died and gone to heaven, because their own taste, their own hard-fought, hard-won taste, all those things that they got in little ones and twos out of Provence or wherever, were in one shop.
We pay a trip to Tom Dixon to talk Terence, habitat and how food and design go hand in hand.
Food and furniture go together really rather well, given that you need a table to eat off.
And at the end of the show, we'll finally sit down with the man himself.
You know, I've always had the ambition to make home furnishings that anybody can buy.
That was Sir Terence Conran in his Shad Thames apartment. Also in the show, we talk to Design Museum director Dejan Sujic about Conran's retrospective and longtime Conran collaborator and friend Stephen Bailey. All that and much, much more coming up on Section D. But first, it's time for this week's design news with Gillian DeBias.
British architect David Chipperfield has been selected as curator of next year's Venice Architecture Biennale. The announcement had been delayed following Silvio Berlusconi's replacement of Biennale director Paolo Baratta with his own friend Giulia Malgara. Following Berlusconi's resignation, it's thought Baratta will hold on to his position as festival director. Chipperfield will be the first British person to curate the world's biggest architecture festival. Edward Lineker, a student from Swinburne University of Technology in Melbourne, has won the James Dyson Award for Innovative Engineering. The £10,000 award has the simple brief to design something that solves a problem. Lineker's design, called Airdrop, extracts water from the air in even the driest regions, cooling air to the point of condensation. Airdrop is designed to help irrigate regions facing drought. And finally, visitors crossing the Georgian-Turkish border will now be greeted by the most spectacular customs checkpoint we've ever seen. Designed by German maverick architect Jürgen Meyer-Haar and opened this month, the checkpoint looks part Matisse sculpture, part children's toy.
Hello and welcome to a Terence Conran love-in here on Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald. There can be very few people who haven't heard of Sir Terence Conran, but for anyone in the dark, he's the closest thing Britain has to a household name in design. When he opened the first Habitat on London's Fulham Road in the 1960s, Conran burst onto the UK scene, promising a better life through good design. It was a revolutionary concept for a new generation in the UK. And who better to take us through its impact than the journalist, commentator and author of the seminal Sloane Ranger handbook, Peter York.
I wrote something about Conranism way back, and I had to dig deep and research how people reacted to the first famous bit of Conranism. I mean, in fact, Conranism had been going on since the mid-50s when he was designing things and talking to Medialand about designing things, and you will see a lot about that. And then opening, as it were, soup kitchens for smart, more dash than cash people in the King's Road and so on. But the point at which he became important and focusing and really bigly famous was with the opening of Habitat, which was sort of, I'm trying to remember, I think
67.
And at that point, you see all the people are saying, all the media commentators are saying, it was as if we'd died and gone to heaven, because their own taste, their own hard-fought, hard-won taste, all those things that they got in little ones and twos out of Provence or wherever, were in one shop. Assembled as a lifestyle, at last, as they used to say, at last a shop for us. You know, in the preppy handbook, they say, you know, last a book for us, Muffy. Well, at last a shop for us. And so the sort of string along terraces of newly enfranchised sort of Camden Town, Primrose Hill, etc., newly enfranchised, newly gentrified, could find their taste ready. And that was a wonderful thing, because you just think about the reality that it must have been set against, the daily reality of what it... See Maples and Die. See Maples and Die. Maples was a very big sort of Tottenham Court Road furniture department store. And the world of mass furnishings, or even not mass furnishings. Now, what Harrods had to sell you in furniture terms was just as grim. So until then, there simply weren't shops like that. There was Heels, and they were importers of the Danish look, the Scandi look. That was about it for the whole country. That culture didn't exist outside little bits of London W1. That was completely it. And the idea that there might be a mini chain spreading that to the rest of the land was completely wonderful. And it coincided with a lot of people doing new occupations and a lot of people for the first time going into higher education. So it was brilliantly timed. By definition, there was a larger audience for that sort of thing. And there was a large dedicated media coverage, because there were colour supplements. So the timing was absolutely right.
And you mentioned earlier about Conranism. I mean, so it did explode in the 60s, but how did it develop after that? Because today we think of Terence Conran as this business entrepreneur who has, he's put one or two feet wrong, but he's sort of continued to grow. Now he's 80, he's still as busy as ever.
The point about Terence Conran was that he wasn't just good at designing things, and people debate endlessly how good was he, how did he compare with his contemporaries. But what made it work was that he was a brilliant proselytizer and media worker, media exploiter, and a very good organizer and retailer. So he knew how to get that stuff out to people. And as the world developed, and as his people developed, as they went on for their first bout of higher education into the world and started to make money, and were educated meritocrats, as they went on, he was just that little relevant bit ahead of them, supplying them with what they wanted and knowing when to get big. I mean, there was that thing when Conran attempted to go into the high street, but it was a rather uncomfortable sort of potential merger deal with a business too big and too crass, really, of him. And it didn't end terribly well. But in a way, he was right to do it. He was right to try it. One of the things, sometimes you go to bits of Britain, you would go to bits of Britain not very far from here, like Romford, and you'd look at the habitat in the high street in Romford and think, the demographics on the face of it, if we just look at the numbers, you look at the incomes locally, absolutely support it. The culture, the local culture, the local aesthetic, absolutely doesn't. So habitat was, forever and a day, very southern, quite home counties, all those things. It was most successful in that and in cathedral towns.
And actually, you hit upon a point which I think sums up Sir Terence Conran perfectly, which is that he understood what people wanted. And that's something that it's an indefinable quality, something that so few people really, for all their MBAs and endless marketing qualifications, get right today. Do you feel that with Sir Terence, he is a maverick at that? It's something that you can't really learn.
Well, certainly it was very much instinctive, because he wasn't taught those things. He didn't go to business school, and he certainly didn't do an MBA. He went to Central School and studied art and design and those things, Central, which later became Central St Martin's. So, and he went to an arty public school, Bryanston, which is the thing I completely relate to, and that particular strand in British culture, which is the arty end of the upper middle classes. He did all those things instinctively. He knew who his people were instinctively. He'd hit the right audience because the world was changing in the right ways. And he kept ahead of them, but not too far ahead of them.
And actually reading so much about him in the past few weeks, months, as these endless articles and programmes on radio and television celebrating his 80th birthday, you realise that in many ways he was an editor in the EUR sense of things rather than the magazine sense of things. He's just somebody with very, very good taste and a good business nose who has managed to make people aware of things that they need without them, or one step ahead of them, knowing it themselves, like the duvet, for instance.
And he proselytised very effectively for design as a career, as a sort of sacrament, and all those things. He was the most effective proselytizer for design, and he was very good at selling design into businesses, because alongside the shops and the stuff, he had one of the first big commercial design practices, and he got big businesses to subscribe to it, and the brand certainly helped.
And what do you think, I mean, it's very morbid almost that we're talking about him in terms of his legacy, but what do you think his legacy will be? What one thing would you remember Terence Conran for?
I think it's the thing of establishing a certain strand and continuing a certain strand of British taste, which took fiendish European modernism and added to it a completely vernacular strand, which could have come almost from the arts and crafts. Anyway, rather significantly, he said that when he went around grand houses when he was young, he liked the design below stairs, because it was fit for purpose, and yet it was quite grand in its own way. And he very much admired that. And he allied those two things, the stuff you were taught by rote of the fiendish modernism and that British tradition, and keeping it going, and in turn handing it on to people, well, handing on very directly, like to people like Mr. Morrison, and yet a young Mr. Conran, and younger Mr. Conran, and to Sebastian, and then a whole host of extended family people, but much more widely than that, keeping that stuff going. I think that's quite something.
Thank you very much for joining us, Peter York. You're back with Section D here on Monocle 24. Terence Conran was pioneering not just for his belief that good design has the power to improve quality of life, but in his own prowess at combining design and business. It's a relationship that's more relevant today than ever, as our next guest understands only too well. British industrial designer Tom Dixon is arguably the closest thing we have today to a 21st century Conran. The former head of design at Habitat, Dixon now has his own empire in West London, combining a restaurant with a shop, his studios and offices. Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove, swung by to quiz him on Conran's legacy and how the designer paved the way for Dixon's own career.
I'm here with the designer Tom Dixon in his shop, surrounded by his designs in Ladbroke Grove. Tom, I wanted to start by asking you about the trajectory of design and where you think Conran fits in. How do you think he changed the taste of British consumers?
Well, Terence was in the right place at the right time, and he had a kind of unique mix of design sensibility and entrepreneurial skill. And I think, post-war England was an incredibly drab place, which was compounded by the fact that we'd gone through, 100 years of industrial revolution, and people had gone a long way from the land. The rationing hadn't really finished until something like 1956. And so people had been used to eating things like dried eggs and Spam for, something approaching 15 years, by the time Conran started operating. So when he went and he travelled extensively in Europe and saw and felt the quality of life that could be had with simple and humble ingredients and freshness and the new sensibility in Italian design. And he brought that back to the UK just at the right time.
And was he ever a mentor for you?
By the time I reached Habitat, and it had been out of Terence's empire for almost 10 years. So although I knew him, I knew him mainly through contact with his kids, like Sebastian and Tom Conran were pals of mine. I didn't really have him in any mentoring situation at all, apart from the few odd letters when I got things wrong. So he was disgusted I put plastic Christmas trees in the window one year, for instance. And, you know, he kept a really close eye on what was going on there. But you couldn't help through studying the legacy, you know, because I read lots and lots of material on, you know, particularly on the period at the very beginning of Habitat in 1964. You know, there was a lot to learn about, you know, the embracing of design in all of its forms that has stood me in good stead ever since. And also the idea of the designer as entrepreneur rather than just as somebody that makes shapes, I thought was very influential for me.
And can you give me a bit of an idea about what happened to Habitat? I mean, it was his creation and you were there at the helm for nearly a decade. Give me an insight into sort of how it sort of had such a falling off.
Well, it wasn't my fault, okay. No, I mean, I think, Terence had done an extraordinary job of creating a what's now called lifestyle, you know, a sort of select shop. You know, you see all of these shops like Colette and Corso Como, which are select shops. But Habitat was really the first one to do that, to not only present the work of great international designers, but surround it with found objects from all over the globe, which were of substance and freshness, you know. So the starting of it with one or two shops as kind of select shops with a very loyal and probably quite fashionable clientele in the centre of London was followed by a very swift expansion into many, many shops because it was a great success and there was nothing else like it at the time. And Terence is always better when he's got his personal attention on something. So when the empire had grown, there was a couple of external factors like recessions, you know, the 70s, the three-day week. It was a miserable time, power cuts, you know, people with no money. Sounds familiar. And then also an interest in expanding the empire beyond just Habitat and, you know, the kind of takeover of BHS and various other mother care meant that Terence's attention wasn't fully on his baby. So when the whole thing collapsed due to another recession, I think, somewhere like in 83, it was snapped up by IKEA, mainly as a category killer rather than with a real direction. You know, they sensed that it was an opportunity, but they never really exploited it. They never really understood the difference between IKEA and Habitat. And IKEA being so very successful always felt like a very small and insignificant, deformed brother of the big organisation IKEA. So when I arrived there, you know, I did what I could and I had a fantastic time and had a series of what I felt were successes, but the reality is it was in the wrong ownership and IKEA were never going to be able to understand why people would pay more for intangibles, basically. So I think, you know, the whole IKEA model is based really on making design affordable, and Habitat was about a very different thing. So you couldn't really apply the IKEA rules to Habitat, and I think it was in wrong ownership for almost 15 or more, 20 years, I don't know. And so I left because I couldn't really take it any further. I was obviously not Terence Conran because I didn't own the joint, so I couldn't, you know, there was a limit to what I could do. And it really needed to be in the hands of somebody else like Terence, which was who had entrepreneurial flair and spirit. I mean, there's lots of people like that on the British High Street right now, but IKEA are a much more democratic organisation. It was never going to thrive under their ownership.
And have you used a kind of Conran ethos to create your businesses? I mean, we're here at Dock, it's sort of hybrid, there's a restaurant, there's a shop. Are his sort of ideas here?
Well, I think everybody who's got a shop that incorporates more than, know, a single category of homewares has got to be indebted to Terence Conran and his legacy. So, yes, I mean, and you know, I do think that some of the departure points were exactly the same. Terence started off the business because he was a furniture designer, and he was finding it difficult to find the correct environment to show his wares. The food element is something definitely that's also got a hint of what Terence was doing, but IKEA also had food in their store. So I think, you know, food and furniture go together really rather well, given that you need a table to eat off, you know what I mean? So there's a logic there which, you know, Terence spotted a bit earlier than anybody else.
Keep abreast of everything from breaking news to fresh business opportunities with Monocle 24's lineup of live weekday current affairs programmes. The Globalist kicks off our day at 6 a.m. UK time with 2 hours of news, media reviews, weather and reports from our correspondents around the world. At midday UK time, The Briefing helps the North American East Coast get into gear with a brisk review of news and analysis. And at 18:30 UK, Midori House gets a first read on stories hitting Asia's front pages and does a roundup with Monocle's editors. Finally, the Monocle Daily signs on for 2 hours at 2200 with a mix of our editors and special guest anchors to start the day in Asia. Keep an eye and an ear on the world, right here on Monocle 24.
There are few greater pleasures in life than a great meal. The Menu is just that, a weekly one-hour programme about eating and drinking. From growers to restaurateurs, we introduce you to the people you need to know, whether you're out dining in Osaka or out carousing in Sao Paulo. That's The Menu, brought to you in association with Krug, every Tuesday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and on iTunes.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. More than furnishing a million homes in the UK with good, affordable design from Habitat, Conran's more enduring footprint was the founding of the London Design Museum, first at the Boiler House in 1980 and then at its Shad Thames home in 1989. At his side was Stephen Bailey, one of the world's leading authorities on design, a long-term collaborator and friend of Sir Terence. In his office off London's Carnaby Street, Bailey explains about Conran the man and myth.
You know, Terence is a colossus of his strides, all the known earth. You know, I mean, all the things I'm interested in, Terence represented. I couldn't overestimate how much influence Terence has had on my own, you know, view of the world. I think we're dealing with several levels of mythology when you're dealing with Terence. There's the myth about design. I mean, you know, design as an autonomous sort of, you know, numinous entity. But I mean, most of all, the idea of good design. Terence believes in the absolute rightness of. He wouldn't call it taste, but he would call it. He calls it good design. It is that whole design phenomenon is a little bit of a myth. I'm not saying design doesn't exist. Of course it does. You know, it's what I make my living out of it. But it's not. It's no longer that thing which Terence believed it was. I mean, what Terence did do, he absolutely detests the term lifestyle. Being such a demented Francophiliac, I mean, Terence doesn't call it lifestyle. He would rather call it l'art de vivre. There's the whole Conran myth itself. There's the whole biography of, you know, Terence, which, I mean, like all mythologies, it's, you know, partly true.
It's the myth about his life, then.
Well, the whole thing, well, the stories, which I hope you're not going to just brainlessly, uncritically pass on. I mean, Terence is an absolute total megalomaniac. You know, if Terence does something, he is the megalomaniac in the Steinbergian sense, like Steinberg's Manhattan. I mean, Terence sees himself as the centre of the world. I mean, Terence, the thing you've got to understand about Terence, he's just very, very linear, as I said, very megalomaniac. He doesn't see grey things, and he just moves. He believes in a virtuous form of progress. All his restaurants, when he had them, they were brilliant when they started, because he's there, and he's focused, and he's manic, and he's attentive, and he's nagging, and he's shouting, and he's arguing. And they're brilliant while he's there, and then his focus moves on, and they just fall into a, you know, weary sort of desuetude. And that Habitat is now dead, you know. He's sort of become what he was afraid of.
I mean, there's some reasons why he has this big exhibition at the Design Museum. But people still think of Terence Conran as having established sort of modern life in Britain.
That's because Terence told me that. I just want to talk about the myth of, you know, the myth of Habitat, you know, the myth of Conrad. I mean, both France and the myth of, you know, Terence's version of design, they were both a remedy for the, you know, the boredom of suburban England. They were means of, you know, food and design, and means of escape. And meanwhile, Terence is totally surrounded by the encompassing Roma of sophisticated Chelsea. Never forget, he actually comes from Esher. Of course, Terence doesn't have this concept of, you know, of taste. He thinks his own, well, he does, he thinks his own taste is universal. It's only a matter of, you know, just give the poor and unwashed enough time to be exposed to Terence's taste, and they will be converted. The concept of the design museum, which was, I think probably true to say, originally mine, managed to get Terence interested in it and funding it, which is marvellous. But, you know, Terence, with sort of genius, turned it round to, the idea was that, you know, I would promote a certain type of design, which would then excite the public into, you know, a frenzy of enthusiasm for Habitat, and they would go out and spend more money in Habitat, which would therefore give us more money in the design museum to carry on promoting design. But then the whole world of design became slightly more complicated. Terence's own business expanded and then sort of vaguely collapsed. You know, he took his eye off Habitat as he did, and, you know, it was the strangest thing, because Habitat was such a good idea, and it's so desperate even in this country. If you reinvented Habitat now, it would still be brilliant.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Huge hole waiting to be filled.
Absolutely. And yet Terence, I think, knows that. He went, you know, makes him sad, I think, to think about it. He took his eye off Habitat and he wanted, like everybody else in the
80s. Does he admit that?
Terence has never admitted an error, ever. You know, part of the thing about Terence is he's an inspired and at his best an inspiring individual, but he's actually not, he's a sort of terrible manager. They're really truly terrible. You know, he is the absolute paradigm of a driven, creative, you know, individual, you know, restless, full of ideas. Many of the ideas not his own, but that's, you know, great artists don't borrow, they steal. We all know that to be true. But he did actually do it. He did actually put the furniture together. He did actually open the shops. He did actually do, you know, they may not have always had quite the sort of status and resonance to which Terence attached them, but he knew. In a world where so many people are sort of pallid underachievers, I mean, there's no one could accuse Terence of underachieving.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Then a Monocle 24 project, yeah.
Monocle 24, yokoso.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
You're back with Section D here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. And it's time for our weekly global shopping spree. Keeping in line with our Conran theme, we set the tills ringing in shops that sell British design, and we started in Delhi.
I'm Sachin Vaish. I manage a menswear bespoke tailoring business in New Delhi called Vaish at Rivoli. We've been here since 1940, and the business was started by my grandfather, Mr. O.P. Vaish. So in 1950, my grandfather went to England to Savile Row to learn the art of cutting and fitting men's clothing, and we've been here since. My father went in 1970, and I've been there too in the 90s. So we have an upscale business. We sell a lot of cloth traditionally from the UK as well. So we used to have brands like Dorme, Holland & Sherry, Wayne Shell, and some others from Huddersfield. And the essence of our business was Savile Row tailoring. So we would make hand canvassed suits, which we do till date. Savile Row is the high end for tailored clothing. So it's about getting something that fits with your personality and not just with your body. And we make an effort to do that. So it involves 2 to 5 fittings to get the right suit. The attention to detail that you show in what you wear will tend to show that you have that attention to detail in everything that you do. My grandfather used to say that it is his British clients who taught him the business to begin with. So he wasn't trained to do this when he started at the age of 19. He started it as a business. But when he had his first clients were British Army officers who a lot of who were very impeccably dressed, a lot of who had allowances to spend on Savile Row for their officers' clothing. The British goods, also fabrics, we import a lot of British fabrics. They are inherently associated with solid feel and quality, with durability, with not being flimsy or light. It's now more to do with the technical aspect of the fact that British is associated with more solid, with more strength, rather than simply style. So we find a lot of people saying they've tried the Italian brands and now they say, oh, we'd like a traditional British cloth and let it be solid. So that is the appeal that it has.
Well, so my name is Antoine. You know, I'm the house tailor in Old England, Paris. I do suits for each and everyone since a very long time. We buy, you know, material in England, tweeds and everything, and fancy lining too. And we try to do the best we can do. You know, we make suits, sport jackets, overcoats, a lot of things. I learned to do it in England very long time ago. My father was self-account manager in London for Limpton Limited, the tea merchant. It's a very old story for myself. A lot of people in Paris like to wear something a little bit British. It's a very old story since two centuries ago. Napoleon III was customary in England, you know, for a suit, and the English tailors that everything starts, you know, day by day, and also for the quality of the material from England. The Scottish material for tweed jackets and the North England material for suits are very, you know, strong, and this doesn't shrink, you know. It's, a lot of people like this quality for a while, you know, since a very long time too, you know. This is, you know, a suit. This we make it, you know, in 4 yard of material from Scotland. We bought the material in Scotland and we make in France the fashion. But it's very English. It's a three-button suit with a double cut on the back. It's working buttonholes for the sleeves. It's got, you know, a small vest with four pockets. It's got a narrow trouser, you know, for the bottom. No pleats in the front. Pen pocket, you know, on the back. A wallet pocket too. Hook bar just on the side. It's not so expensive first. The material is perfect and the cut and the style is very fashionable for a long time.
So I'm Mark Windekilde and I'm the creative director of Happy Shop in Berlin, which is a new concept shop. And the shop is all about presenting sort of new brands that are not represented in Germany or in Berlin for that matter, and to introduce people to a more innovative, maybe high fashion kind of design and that normally are represented in any capital, you know, Paris, London, New York, Tokyo, but not represented in Berlin. One of our best-selling brands is a Japanese brand called Toga Archives, which is like very classic Tokyo girl in the sense of how you imagine Tokyo style, sort of.
Yeah, yeah.
And somehow it really fits the Berlin customer, the Berlin woman. In particular, they really love it and think it's because it's a little bit hard and not too soft, not too girly. From the UK, we sell Madame Kirchhoff, which is a beautiful brand, and we had it sort of from the beginning when the shop opened. It's a little bit, again, a lot of customers say that it reminds them of like this folklore kind of old-fashioned-y kind of, you could say, but in a modern take. Sort of like it's also like a classic woman. It's also a little bit the current collection is a little bit witchy, you could say, bewitched, or how do you say, like wicked, but with a Chanel twist, I would say. And so it's many things, but it's definitely it's produced in the UK, and I would say that it's definitely a selling point for many customers. I mean, customers that come into our shop, they know, because of the price also and because of the how it's produced, where it's produced, you know, it does matter where it's produced. And if it's produced in the EU also, people do care about it. If it's produced in Japan, and it's definitely like a selling point. I mean, but otherwise we sell also House of Holland, and we do some Christopher Kane as well. I mean, I'm a big fan of London myself, so yes, I would say London is still trendy. For me, London will never go out of style.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time, and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle cafe and shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop, stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
You're back with Section D here on Monocle 24. As the founder and chief funder of the Design Museum in London, it's only fitting that for Terence Conran's 80th birthday, it should mark the celebration with a retrospective of the man's work. Sneaking behind the scenes the day before its opening, I caught up with the Design Museum's current director, Dejan Sucic, to talk Terence and take me through the exhibition and the next chapter and new life of the London Design Museum.
One of the things that I discovered fairly early on when we were curating the exhibition was that some things just repeat themselves in Terence's life. He loves to collect things. He loves to show things in bulk to give that sense of generosity. He loves to make patterns. And that really goes back to the days when he was an evacuee during wartime London's bombing to rural Hampshire, and he started collecting butterflies. So there's a tray here, actually it's a photograph, of this beautiful tray of butterflies, which is sitting in his study down in the country, which he collected when he was a schoolboy, probably 14 or 15, which he's kept ever since. And it's beautiful, but it also shows the way that his mind works, that he loves to make patterns out of things. I mean, this was basically standing in an evocation of Terence's study from Barton Court down in Berkshire. And on one side of us, we have actually his books, his desk, his Eames chair at his desk, his maquette by Thomas Heatherwick of a gazebo piece that Thomas designed when he was still a student, which is now in Terence's garden. On the shelves behind the desk, it's crammed with little models that show the pieces that Terence has designed himself. His cigar box, his pencils, his lamp. Really evoking what it's like for him to be in the space in which he works. And on the other wall, there's a wall full of miniature Bugatti racing cars at one end, pedal cars. There's a cluster of corks. There's an 18th century Chippendale piece of furniture full of great 18th century glasses in it. The butterflies we've talked about, books, just the mind of a collector, brushes. He loves that sense of abundance in creating patterns with things.
Fantastic. So that's a great snapshot of Terence's life and work and sort of insight into the way he lives and collects.
Well, I thought another thing to talk about that's key is Terence's impact on the way that we eat. Craig Brown once did rather wittily suggest that before Terence Conran existed, there would have been no France, that Terence discovered France for the British public. And that is somewhat of an exaggeration, but back in the late 40s, early 1950s, when Britain was going through austerity, when the national cuisine was toad in the hole and reconstituted meat, the idea that there was another way of eating, that sense of Elizabeth David's book of Mediterranean recipes, that sense of olive oil and fresh ingredients in French markets, was something that seemed very appealing. Terence went to France, worked for a while in a restaurant in Paris, came back and started his first restaurant, The Soup Kitchen. And that sense of creating restaurants has been something that Terence has always been fascinated by, places in which to see and be seen, to enjoy delicious food, good conversation. We're standing in front of a wall of evocations of a dozen of the restaurants that he's been involved with. Many different styles. You know, at one end you can see Bibendum with its Otto Wagner cafe chairs, Plateau with a Sarin and Tulip chair.
I mean, Terence also in many ways, we're standing in his greatest legacy, the Design Museum. And he founded that really with the goal of educating, as well as having a foot in, a very sort of physical foot that showed the importance of design to life. Has that mission changed, do you think, now? I mean, the Design Museum is entering a very big next chapter when it moves to the Commonwealth Institute. Is the mission of the Design Museum still the same?
Terence has been very passionate about the importance of contemporary design, not just the expert, not just the specialist, but as something which is a crucial aspect of everyday life. Design, for me and the museum, is a way to understand the world around us. It's a reflection of our cultural values. It reflects what we believe is important, how we approach the public realm, but it's also about creating jobs. We've been here at the Shad Thames Design Museum building for the last 24 years, and by 2014 we hope to be in our new home in the form of Commonwealth Institute, where we can grow from our current 200,000 visitors a year to 500,000 visitors. It's extraordinary how Terence's career reflects the history of design in Britain over the last six decades. And as a measure of how far the world has changed, it's remarkable to look at this case, which has in it Nicholas Pevsner's Pioneers of Modern Design, the 1946 edition, which Terence read just as leaving school, and which took him from an interest in the British arts and crafts to the Bauhaus. There's a syllabus from the Central School of Arts and Crafts, as the Central was called in those days, for 1948, the year in which Terence became a student there and dropped out after a year and a half, basically because he was offered a job working for the architect Dennis Lennon at the Festival of Britain. And there's a catalogue here for the Festival of Britain back in 1951. The sudden explosion of the sense that there might be a modern Britain after the decades of wartime austerity. It's a long time ago, 60 years ago. It shows how far Terence and his generation of designers have taken since then.
Do you feel that 50 years from now people will appreciate him still for his contribution to British life and living?
It's arguable that he introduced the great British public to the concept of the duvet, so he changed our practices in the bedroom. He certainly changed the living room. He changed the way we ate out. He changed the way that we live.
We've painted enough of a picture of Sir Terence Conran in other people's eyes. All that's left is to hear from the great man himself. In his penthouse apartment in Shad Thames, overlooking the river, he delved into his life and work and what he hopes he'll be remembered for.
The way we live now.
Yeah.
Did you choose the title?
No, Dan chose the title.
Oh, no.
And it's, I can't remember what author it is now.
Is it Thackeray?
I think, I have a feeling it is, yes. And I said, well, it really should be how some of us live now.
I mean, the way we live now is very different to the way we lived in the 60s.
Oh, it certainly is totally and completely different. Life in the 50s, which was when I really started, was execrable. I think that's the right word for it. You know, you couldn't buy any modern furniture then. Well, I suppose you could if you went to extreme lengths to try and find it. If you went to Denmark, you could find modern furniture then. It was very much a Fabian thing, I think, a taste in modernity.
As you grew up, did you think, actually, this furniture and the sensibility that goes into making something very simple and functional has a much wider possibility for...
Yeah. Well, as you may have seen from the exhibition, I've always made things. My parents gave me a workshop at our house in the country, and I had welding equipment and a lathe and did a lot of metalworking, woodworking, made things. I even had a pottery wheel and a wood-fired kiln in the garden. So I was always making things.
And do you consider yourself first and foremost a designer then?
Yes, a design entrepreneur, I suppose.
I know various people try and pigeonhole you as a businessman beyond a designer, but I don't feel that you like being described as that.
No, I certainly would hate to be called just a businessman, but you know, I have always recognised that you have to have a successful business to make things happen, and I really enjoy making things happen.
Something else that strikes me from looking at the range of your work is that you have an uncanny knack for knowing what people want before they probably know it themselves. Is that just the luck of intuition? Or
I think I'm quite good at spotting gaps in the marketplace, you know, what people might want if they were offered it. And I think my whole food side, we bought the Michelin building mainly for the Conran shop, but also for Paul Hamlin's publishing empire. And we both said, you've got to have a restaurant here. And so we did a Bendham restaurant, which turned out to be such a success. I thought, well, it's the opportunity to do a few more of these. And, you know, actually in doing it, I found how much I was enjoying it. And so, although I'd done a very simple cafe in 1952.
It was the soup kitchen.
Soup kitchens. The restaurant proper, I thought, well, really, this is terrific. Must do more of this. So, you know, I was spotting a gap in the market.
And talking about gaps in the market, I mean, Habitat is something that most people associate with you.
I know.
And
dead and gone in the UK, but alive and well in the continent.
Which is extraordinary and quite sad.
Very, very sad indeed. However, we have Marks and Spencer's project as the alternative. And, you know, to work with Marks and Spencer's, it's been my dream all my working life.
Why is that?
Well, it's the democracy that it goes out to the whole nation, rich or poor. You know, it's available everywhere and all over the place. And, you know, I've always had the ambition to make home furnishings that anybody can buy, you know, rather than a small, you know, the Conran shop is a small market. It doesn't reach out east, west, south and north.
And when you look at the state of design today, which is an industry that is a million times bigger and more complex than it was in the 1950s and 1960s.
We weren't even called designers then. We were called industrial artists.
Exactly. It was a completely, there was no widespread notion or understanding of what it was even.
Design wasn't in most people's vocabulary.
I mean, how do you feel it is for a young person growing up now who wants to be a designer?
I think an awful lot of people do want to be designers now, but I don't know that they actually quite know what it entails. And I hope the exhibition may help certainly the vast number of school children that come to the Design Museum understand a bit more about it and excite them to think, well, I really might like to be a designer.
Another great sort of thread that's run through your career is your drive to educate people, be it about design and the importance and possibility of very simple design to improve quality of life, or
plain, simple and useful, my slogan.
Do you have any regrets when you look back? Do you wish maybe that you'd held on to Habitat?
Or? Yes, I do wish I'd held on to Habitat, because Habitat could have been what IKEA now is. And it's bizarre that IKEA bought it and let it collapse.
You have a great knack for instinct. It's not the way that businesses are necessarily run nowadays.
No.
It tends to be for the worse.
Somebody asked me the question, when was I going to retire? And I said, I had no intention of ever retiring. I'll hope I'll die with unfinished projects, because my work is my hobby. Some people have yachts in the Mediterranean and play golf. I don't. Everything I do in my life, even down to my gardening side, is productive. And somebody the other day said to me about my house in the country, which has got the old farm buildings attached, converted to Benchmark, this woodworking furniture making factory that I run there, which has got about 50 people working in it. They said, why do you want to have a factory in your garden? I said, I love it. It's productive. It employs people. And I get the greatest pleasure from designing something on a Sunday, making a model of it on Monday and Tuesday, and seeing by Friday a working prototype. Just, is really fulfilling.
But do you hope that 100 years from now people remember Sir Terence Conran for?
Oh gosh. I hope they will see me as a designer who made things that were plain, simple and useful in a world that has got terribly overcomplicated, and that my life had allowed people to furnish their homes and their workplaces in a more relaxed and easy way. There wasn't anything pretentious about my philosophy.
That was Sir Terence Conran. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this week. Happy birthday, Sir Terence. As one young fan, I salute you. Next week, we leave London behind and take a spin around the world, talking to key design figures in key cities to hear how their hometowns are using design and architecture to improve their quality of life. Until then, get your hands on a Conran chicken brick. Thank you for listening.